Well, I'm very pleased to be here. After so long, I think we started thinking of this. I don't know when it was. Was it last year, last summer, or something like that, when Jan and I came back from a trip out west? We came through, I guess we stopped with the Rock Island community, and talking about Islam in the course of talking about a lot of other things. And I guess from there, the idea grew, and eventually it came about. Well, as the chairman announced, the purpose of our institute this weekend is to discuss and study Islam together. And thinking about it, it seems to me that we could divide this up into three particular things that I want to try and accomplish this weekend. The first, and probably the basic thing, is this: to get a greater understanding of Islam and the Quran, the book associated with the revelation of Muhammad, just to understand it better, to understand what it is, what Muhammad said, who he was, what happened to him in his life, things like that, because it is one in a series of progressive revelations. As we know from the Baha'i faith, revelation is progressive manifestations of God who follow each other. Each one abrogates some of the laws of the preceding dispensation, gives a new dispensation. We want to see how Islam fits into the scheme, fits into the overall plan of God. Second thing we want to do, I think, is to get some greater understanding of the Islamic references which occur in the Baha'i writings. When you read a book such as the Book of Certitude, the Kitab-i-Iqan, or the Gleanings, or the Seven Valleys, or any of many other books, we find in reading such a book that in many places the writer, Baha'u'llah, refers to Islam. He quotes from the Quran, and the quotation is sort of self-contained. One can see what he's talking about, but we can get a great deal more by looking at the context of the quotation and why that quotation was originally revealed by Muhammad, what its purpose was, and things like that. By going back to that, then in turn, we can get a greater understanding of why Baha'u'llah selected that quotation in, say, the Book of Certitude. Likewise, Baha'u'llah, for example, in the Book of Certitude, makes passing reference to all kinds of things connected with Islam. For example, I think on page 5 of the Book of Certitude, Baha'u'llah is talking about how manifestations have been rejected whenever they have come. He talks about the things that have happened to manifestations. And he says, I think on page 5, that if anybody were to meditate on a chapter of the Quran called the Surah of Hud, then this would be sufficient for him. Well, we need to go back and see what the Surah of Hud is, how come it's so important that Baha'u'llah said this about it, what's in it, what's it all about, who was Hud, things like that. Those are the kinds of things that we're aiming at. Some of the references of Baha'u'llah to the Quran are very direct, and some of them are very veiled, they're mysterious. There are some terms that occur which are not generally known. Another one that comes to mind is where Baha'u'llah, in the second part of the Book of Certitude, he refers to the hostility of the people of Khaybar in the days of Muhammad. And as we go on, and probably late this afternoon or this evening, we'll talk about some of the things that happened during the life of Muhammad, and we'll see who the people of Khaybar were, what they did, and what happened to them. And in that way, when we go back and study the Book of Certitude, it'll make a lot more sense when we see why Baha'u'llah has referred to the people of Khaybar. Well, those kinds of things. So we want to understand Islam itself as a revelation. Secondly, we want to try and get a greater insight of the Quranic references which occur in the Baha'i writings. And the third thing we want to do, I think, is to look at the prophecies of the Quran which refer to the coming of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. There are a tremendous amount of these. I went through the Quran fairly quickly in preparing for this course, and I guess I wrote down at least 250 different references from the Quran, and some of these are quite long and detailed, so there's a tremendous amount. A great Baha'i scholar, Mr. Abul Fadl, has said that one-third of the Quran is concerned with prophecy about the Bab and Baha'u'llah. And what we'll do, of course, obviously time won't permit us to discuss in detail one third of the Quran, but at least we can see some of the incredible things that are there. And this, I think, is one of the most exciting parts of looking at Islam from a Baha'i viewpoint. You can see how very clearly it was foretold. The fact that there would be two manifestations of God, the term gate or bab is used in this context, the term Baha, the fact that on the day, the promised day that would come, people would stand up and their eyes would shine and they would speak of the glory of God. These things occur in the Quran. It says that Baha'u'llah would call, that the glory of God would call from the abode of peace. And Baghdad, where Baha'u'llah made his declaration, is the abode of peace. It has always been called the abode of peace ever since it was founded as a city many hundreds or over a thousand years ago. There are very explicit and very detailed references to the faith of the Bab and Baha'u'llah in the Quran. We'll want to at least take a look at some of these, and we'll find that when we look at them, that they cast a great deal of insight into the Baha'i teachings. And the overall purpose of it, putting all those three things together, is in fact no more than this, to understand more and more what Baha'u'llah has said and what the Baha'i faith is about. Because we'll see as we go on that the Baha'i faith ties in very closely with some aspects of Islam, although of course Baha'u'llah has abrogated many of the laws of the Quran. We'll look at one point at some of the laws of the Quran and see what they are and see how they have been changed by Baha'u'llah. In this regard, let me read a passage that The Guardian wrote some years ago in 1936, in the August 1936 Baha'i News. The Guardian wrote, and he said through his secretary, "The Guardian would certainly advise and even urge the friends to make a thorough study of the Quran, as the knowledge of this sacred scripture is absolutely indispensable for every believer who wishes to adequately understand and intelligently read the writings of Baha'u'llah." Well, this is very strong language. The Guardian says, firstly, that he advises and even urges us to make a thorough study of the Quran. And obviously, we won't be doing that this weekend. What we'll hope to do this weekend is to make a start on a thorough study of the Quran, but that's not something that one is going to accomplish in a few hours in one weekend. It's a much larger work than that. But at least we can get started on it. And then the other strong part of it is the Guardian says that the knowledge of the Quran is absolutely indispensable if we want to adequately understand the writings of Baha'u'llah. Well, obviously, as Baha'is, we do want to adequately understand the writings, better than adequately if possible, but we'll settle for adequately if nothing else. And in order to do that, the Guardian says knowledge of the Quran is absolutely indispensable. One cannot do without it. So this, I think, provides, at least for me, a high degree of motivation to understand something about Islam, because it seems an essential prerequisite to adequate understanding of the Baha'i teachings. Well, those are the things that we want to do. We will, of course, be approaching it as Baha'is. We'll assume that everybody present has accepted the Baha'i faith, is a Baha'i. We'll assume that whatever the Baha'i writings say is true. We won't get into the thing of proving Baha'u'llah or demonstrating by the process of reason, the truth of what Baha'u'llah said. We'll start off assuming that to be true, as of course we who are Baha'is accept. And we'll find, very interestingly enough, that the Baha'i faith casts remarkable insight into Islam. For example, some things that the Muslims didn't feel were terribly important turn out to be tremendously important from a Baha'i point of view. And as we go on this afternoon, we'll see some examples of this, of little things that occurred during the life of Muhammad, which people tend to gloss over. They were just kind of so what. Whereas now, as Baha'is, we say that that was a very crucial thing, because that tied in with something that the Bab and Baha'u'llah did, or something that they said. It all hooked together. So we're approaching it as Baha'is. The other thing we'll find, of course, is the fact that the writings of the central figures of the faith have shed light on certain things that nobody understood in Islam. When we talk about the prophecies tomorrow, I'll read some prophecies, and the commentators of the Quran have said, and I've read their recent, the most recent commentaries of the Quran, they say, we just don't understand what this is about. We don't have a clue. Basically, we'll see some of the prophecies tomorrow. Some of them are very clear and straight and direct, and some of them are rather veiled. And the commentators said, we don't have a clue. And then we'll read what Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá and in some places the Guardian have said about these and how they've just unlocked the key to them. They've explained them very clearly. Once it's explained, it's obvious. You can see it. Just anybody, you'd think anybody could have seen it. But until it's explained, of course, you can't see it. So we'll see. I found in preparing it that one of the things I got from it was the fact that by going into this subject and preparing for this weekend, I've got a far greater appreciation of the Kitab-i Ikam, of the Book of Certitude, because I see now that not only has Baha'u'llah explained the prophecies of Islam and Christianity relating to the Bab and to his own manifestation, but much more than that, the things that Baha'u'llah interpreted and explained from the Book of Certitude were precisely those things that were most difficult in the Quran and, of course, in the Bible, the things about the stars falling from the heaven and the sun and the moon losing their light and the clouds and all this sort of thing. Same in the Quran. The things Baha'u'llah has explained are the key ones, the pivotal ones, the crucial ones. With those explained, one can use them in order to understand a whole lot more, somewhat easier, prophecy. In other words, Baha'u'llah's taken the hardest ones and explained those, and using those we can understand all the easier ones. So his work in the Book of Certitude cannot be overestimated. One can see why the Guardian says in certain places the Book of Certitude fulfills the prophecy of Daniel, where Daniel said the books would be sealed up until the end of time. And this is the end of time, the end of the age. Baha'u'llah has come. He's unsealed the books. And I hope that I can convey some of this by the time we finish tomorrow. One thing that the Institute is not about, the Institute is not about preparing us to teach Muslims, because the institutions of the faith, the Guardian and the Universal House of Justice, and through them, our National Spiritual Assembly, have pointed out to us that we in the West should not, at this time, seek out Muslims and endeavour to teach them. They have pointed out that if a Muslim approaches us, spontaneously makes an effort to learn about the faith, then we can teach them. We have to be very, very careful, very cautious about teaching Muslims in the West. If any Muslim approaches us and starts coming to firesides and involved in Baha'i activities, we should let our institutions know, particularly our local spiritual assembly. If there's any question, any dubiousness about it, they should consult the National Assembly. We are not permitted to enroll people from an Oriental or particularly a Muslim background. We're not permitted to enroll those people in the United States unless there are certain special circumstances. Yes, Sir Bob. I think there are several reasons. One reason I've become very conscious of since I was appointed to the Auxiliary Board, and that is the fact that there are many instances, particularly in the college towns. We've had instances in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and in Indiana, and in Michigan, of Muslims coming to the Baha'is and deliberately representing themselves as knowing nothing about the Baha'i faith and interested in it. And some of them have done this very, very cleverly. Young students from Pakistan or from Iran or some of the Arab countries have come, outwardly beautiful souls, very, very modest, very presentable, very devout, have said, I've heard Baha'is on campus, it's an Arab word, I'm interested in it, and they become outwardly interested in the faith. And when they sort of get into the infiltrate is the right word to use. When they infiltrate, then they have started to twist and to turn and to try and sow seeds of doubt and to twist the Baha'i writings about. And then it's become clear that, in fact, they knew a great deal about the Baha'i faith and they had presented themselves in this innocent way with the deliberate intention of trying to subvert the faith. We've had several experiences of this in the, whatever it is, 4.5 years, I guess, that I've been associated with the Auxiliary Board. And so we have to be somewhat careful of that. This, of course, happens a great deal in Persia and in to a lesser extent in Pakistan, Muslims come along to the Baha'i meetings there and go through this procedure of deliberately misrepresenting themselves. I remember thinking to myself when I first heard that, there would come a time when, with the growth of the faith in the United States, people from a fanatical Christian background would start doing that also. And sure enough, that started to happen. We've been growing very rapidly at a place called Saginaw, Michigan, just north of Flint. And in the last couple of months, this has been happening. There have been people from a fanatical Christian background have been coming to Baha'i meetings, pretending to know nothing about it. And when they've become very good friends of the Baha'is, then it's become clear they knew a great deal about it and they were sent in deliberately. In some cases, they've been sent from other cities into Saginaw to try and do this. So this is a procedure. But certainly, that's one of the reasons. Another reason is the fact that some of the relatively small group of covenant breakers which exist in the East that have been expelled from the Baha'i faith, they have also used this procedure in the West. It's a small group, but many of that small group have adopted this. So we are therefore given the instruction of not to seek out Muslims. If they approach us, we should be very careful, but maybe they're sincere. We're not prejudging and saying that all Muslims are bad who approach us, but if they approach us and take the initiative, then we can play it along very carefully. Generally, if they are students or temporarily in the United States, they are asked to return to their home country before they enroll in the faith. On the other hand, if they're permanent residents of the United States, they are permitted to enroll. We had a situation like this in Michigan where a Lebanese couple in Michigan from a Muslim background wished to enter the faith. They were permanent residents in the United States. The assembly involved contacted the national. The national felt it was sufficiently important to contact the House of Justice. The House of Justice asked them to get the name of the family where their relatives were in Lebanon. Got that, and then the House got the Lebanese Baha'is to check out that family, to check that it wasn't a family known to be attempting to subvert the faith. And with that checked out, then it said, okay, go ahead and enroll them. So a great deal of caution is used because of this. But Muslims who are found to be sincere are accepted in the faith. My family and myself are a case in point. My family and I are from a Muslim background. We were living in Australia. My parents had emigrated from India, and we made contact with the Baha'is. They checked us out. I think they consulted the Guardian at the time because it was the way the procedure was, and the Guardian advised the Baha'is to proceed cautiously and check out Muslim family in case we were enemies of the faith, and they've decided that we were not. Parents and I were permitted to enter the faith because we were permanent residents of Australia rather than temporary. So that it does happen that Muslims do join in the West, but it is done with a high degree of caution. Yes?
What age did you become
Baha'i? I joined when I was 15. My parents came Baha'i when I was 12. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is the same profession also happening from the Hindus or the
Hindus? Thus far, it isn't. No, it isn't. There's a passage in World Order of Baha'u'llah where the Guardian quotes, I think it's Abdul Baha, about the groaning of China and India and so on. And I've heard of Baha'is who've asked the Guardian about that passage. He said it refers to the very strong opposition which the faith would encounter in India and in China as it advances. And so presumably, part of that opposition will include attempts to infiltrate. This seems to be a relatively standard procedure. And so presumably that will occur, but I don't know that having occurred at this time. I'll probably repeat this sort of warning thing about teaching Muslims, because I can imagine what had happened if I went back to Michigan and the NSA or the council said, you know, since you went to Davenport, everyone's trying to teach Muslims and we're having all kinds of problems. You know, someone would take me out and shoot me or something. So in self-defense, I'll repeat this probably at least once more during the weekend. What I want to do is indicate to you how I'm planning to proceed it. What I want to do in this session is to begin by talking about some of the background and talk about the geography of the area, that's quite important to understanding what happened and why. We need to understand the geography of the area, the society of the time, in order to understand why certain things were done at certain periods. Then I want to look at the history. We won't go into this in great detail, but I want to look at the history of the Middle East around the time of the coming of Muhammad. Again, that's quite important to us to understand some of the things that happened. We need to know the geographical and the historical context because it relates very directly. After that, we'll examine the life of Muhammad, and you'll find that we'll do this in quite a degree of detail. As I go through it, you may at some point wonder why I'm going into so much detail and why I'm talking about things that seem inconsequential. There is a deliberate point to it, and the deliberate point is this, that many of the things that I'll talk about, which might seem very small, I do so because Baha'u'llah mentions them and develops certain points related to them in the Book of Certitude particularly. So for this reason, you know, if you can bear with me when we're going through the history, because some of the things that I'll spend a lot of certain amount of time on will be things that will seem to be very minor. Some of them won't, but a couple of them will. That'll probably take us at least all through the afternoon. I said to Jen, I'm not sure whether this will go on forever or whether it'll stop about 8 p.m., but I think it'll probably take us all through the afternoon. While I'm talking about the history of the dispensation, of the history of the life of Muhammad, what I'd suggest that you do is be thinking about parallels to the history of the Baha'i faith, because that's something that I'd like to discuss. When we finish that, I'm going to stop talking for a while and rest my voice and get everyone else discussing. There are a lot of parallels, I think. I listed about 20 of them just without even thinking. You know, I just sort of was rushed for time and I just zotted down about 20 of them. So I'm sure you'll come up with many more remarkable parallels, which again cast insight into the history of the faith as well as the history of Islam. After that, we'll start looking at the teachings of Islam. We'll examine the Quran in considerable detail and look at the teachings. I've divided them into certain aspects. One aspect are the sort of fundamental spiritual laws of the Quran, which we'll see are pretty much the same as Baha'u'llah has said. Baha'u'llah has developed them in many ways because the society had greater capacity when Baha'u'llah came. We'll see those things. Then we'll look at some of the social laws of Muhammad. And the interesting thing we'll see is that they're an embryonic form of the Baha'i laws. It's very, very interesting to look at the social laws of Muhammad and then the social laws of the Baha'i faith, because we'll see how the Baha'i laws are an evolution of things that were given in a very rudimentary form by Muhammad. We'll also, at that time, take up some popular misconceptions about Islam and about Muhammad. One is on the status of women. The second thing is about the number of wives that Muhammad had. The third thing is about that Islam was spread by the sword, that it's opposed to Christianity. I'm sure you've heard all these things sometimes. We'll go into these in detail and look at them in terms of the Quran. And then tomorrow morning, probably, we'll look at the prophecies in some detail. Depending how time goes, if there is time after that in the final session, we can look at the Book of Certitude and look at some of the Islamic references in there, but it's all kind of fluid. We'll see how we make it. We want to do it fairly informally. When we get tired, we'll stop, you know, whether it's 2 hours or 1 hour or whatever, and stretch and have coffee and then start again. We'll just see how we go. If you feel you're getting tired, just sort of yell out and we'll stop. This is how I've tended to conduct the New Believers conferences I've been involved in, rather than sticking to a rigid schedule. When somebody gets tired, just say, I feel tired, why don't we stop for 10, 15 minutes, and we do that. So just, you know, take it very easy and just relax about that. Interrupt at any time. If there's any question that you have, interrupt, fire away. Don't wait till the end, you'll probably forget the question. Just jump straight in. About 50% of them, I estimate, I'll be able to answer. You know, some of them I won't, some of them I will, but try and see what kind of batting average we come up with. Again, preliminary, before we start, let me mention some of the books that I'll be referring to. The Quran, was for many centuries, for most of the Muslim dispensation, was not translated out of Arabic. And in fact, Arabic became the international auxiliary language of the Muslim dispensation because the Quran was not translated out of Arabic. Devout Muslims wanted to read the Quran, and so they learned Arabic. And this was one of the, I'm jumping right to the end, which is probably the best, worst way of starting, but anyhow, that this was one of the major factors in the growth of the Muslim civilization, the fact that they had an international auxiliary language, international in the sense of wherever Islam expanded from western part of Africa to Indonesia, let's say. You could travel from the Atlantic coast of Africa to Indonesia and speak Arabic and get by. And so it induced a fostering and interchange of ideas and trade and things like that and contributed to civilization. In the last, in the last 50 years, there have been various translations of the Quran. There were others made many hundreds of years ago, and they have become the classics. There's one by Sale, S-A-L-E, which the Guardian at times recommended to the Baha'is, George Sale's translation of the Quran. It is regarded as being a very literary one, quite good English, quite a reasonable kind of a translation. Sale, S-A-L-E, I can write some of these things up, I guess. Let me move this thing over. Sale, George Sale, he was opposed to Islam. He regarded it as a spurious religion, and this comes out in the translation. He has introductory notes and the like, and of course there a very strong prejudice against Islam comes out. One that the Guardian also recommended is by Rodwell. And this is the one in my hand, Rodwell's translation of the Quran. It's in Every Man's edition. It's relatively inexpensive. I bought this in Australia. It cost 9 shillings and 3 pence. I don't know what it would be in America. Maybe $2, something like that. But you can see it's about 400 or 500 pages. And a lot of junk stored in it, but basically it's all there. And you can get some idea of the size of the Quran from this. Roughly, say 30% larger than the New Testament would be a rough figure for the size of it. And this again is regarded as quite a reasonable translation. It is, again, he was a Christian minister, and so he was somewhat opposed to Islam. That comes out in his translation. Some recent translations that are in many ways somewhat better is one, The Meaning of the Glorious Quran by Marmaduke Pictor. I think it's either Signet or Mentor Books. And it's about 75, 80 cents. It's a pretty good translation. About 6 or 7 years ago, I got all the translations I could, and my father and I went through them, picking them pages at random, and comparing it with the original Arabic, which he can read. I can't read Arabic, but he could. And so he could examine the validity or the accuracy of the various translations. And Pictor, we felt, was quite a good translation. It's a very inexpensive, 75, 80 cents, so it's pretty good. There's a very scholarly one by Arbery. Just called the Quran. He's a professor at Oxford University in England, and it flows probably better than Pictor, but Pictor is quite a good, accurate one. The one I will be using is by Yusuf Ali. It is a relatively recently available translation, and it's published by the Islamic Mosque in Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to buy it, I'm not interested in selling it, but if you want to buy it, it's published by the Islamic Mosque, Washington, D.C. That'll be enough address. I think it's $9. And they publish it in one volume. The version I've got is 3 volumes. And that's it. 3 volumes, but it's published in one volume. The reason it's so enormously large is two reasons. One is the fact that it's in English and Arabic. The Arabic doesn't mean anything to me, probably to you either, but at least it's there, English and Arabic. And the English words are fairly large. That's easy to read, whereas this one, the type is minute. And the other thing about it, it has notes, which go along with it. It must have about 4,000 notes. So you can see each page, there are footnotes all over the place. And these are pretty good. They represent a commentary on it, and in the most part, it fits very well. It fits very well to the understanding that the Baha'i faith gives us of the Quran. And so in that sense, it is a reasonably accurate one because we have the Baha'i understanding as a standard, accurate standard of reference. There are a couple of places where he trips up, but mostly it's pretty good. It helps a great deal. I think having the notes, it's much easier to read without the notes. It's pretty difficult. I know many people that have tried Rodwell's Quran and just got no place in it. They can't make head or tail of it and wondered about it. If it wasn't a holy book, you'd think it was nonsense. You know, this kind of stuff, because it's a very difficult book to read, particularly in the Rodwell translation. My personal feeling is the Yusuf Ali translation is easier to read and the notes help a whole lot. Plus the fact that the Yusuf Ali translation has about a 60-page index at the back, which is very, very good, particularly for the prophecies or for the references to some of the people that are mentioned in the Quran. The index is extremely worthwhile. And for that reason, I've tended to use this. When Hand of the Cause, Mr. Furatan, was in the United States 2 or 3 months ago, I guess in August, I was talking to him about translations of the Quran, and he felt that the Yusuf Ali translation was probably about the best one. There is another one by Muhammad Ali, which is also pretty good. He felt Yusuf Ali's was probably a little bit better. We did a kind of spot check. He uses Muhammad Ali's translation because it's the one he's most familiar with, and my father likewise uses Muhammad Ali's for that reason. He also admits that he feels the Yusuf Ali one is better. So I want to recommend that to you. During the course of it, if we ever get around to starting it, we'll be also, I'll be reading certain things which are reputed to be eyewitness accounts of what happened at the time. These are taken originally from a manuscript by a person called Ibn Ishraq. It's not terribly important that you remember the name, so it's hardly worth writing up. Ibn Ishraq is well known in Islamic history as a sort of a rough equivalent of Nabil. He lived at the time. He was very interested. He tracked down things. He chased down all the people who were there at any particular time and got their eyewitness accounts of what happened, and he wrote it all down. And where he wasn't sure that somebody was accurately remembering, he said so. And where he was sure, he said, "I feel sure this is true." And so in all the accounts, he qualified him. He said, "This I'm sure is true. This I'm not so sure." And some of the places he says, "God knows whether this is right or not." You know, he's very direct. Ibn Ishraq also quotes a number of sayings of Muhammad, traditions, which we will talk about somewhat later. And in each case, he identifies who told him and who told that person. So we will get into it, we'll find some sayings of Muhammad, and he'll say, you know, this person told me, someone else told him, that person was told by another person, all the way back to somebody was there when Muhammad said it. In other words, he traces it back. There is a particular Arabic word for this, which we'll talk about when we talk about the traditions, but essentially it is a means of tracing them back. The traditions were the sayings of Muhammad. They were distinct from the Quran. The Quran was written down as was revealed by Muhammad. We'll talk about the process of revelation. The sayings were just the pilgrim notes, if you will. And after the passing of Muhammad, the pilgrim notes were written down and they got out of hand completely. There were hundreds of thousands of them. And eventually a great scholar called Al-Bukhari investigated them and reduced the number of traditions from 600,000 to what he felt were about 10 or 15,000 that could be relied on. And he wrote a 20-volume work in which he set out those traditions. Well, Ibn Ishraq was a person who interviewed the eyewitnesses. He wrote it all down. He wrote a history. Some of Ibn Ishraq's history was lost. The manuscript was not preserved because it was 1,300 years ago. But most of it was. About 200 years after Muhammad, another Muslim called Ibn Hisham took all that he could find of Ibn Ishraq's manuscript and he put it together and he edited it. And he made his own comments where he said this was a bit that got lost, we don't know what happened between there and there, and he made own comments from his own history. And he also did a pretty scholarly job in that he kept his own comments separate from what Ibn Ishraq said. So we know what Ibn Ishraq said, and we also know what the editor didn't sort of mess it up. He put his comments at the back of the book all by themselves. And this second person, Ibn Hisham, his manuscript has survived to the present day, and it was translated just a few years ago by Professor Guillaume in England, and it's published and called The Life of Muhammad. And I just came across this in the University of Michigan Library just a couple of weeks ago. It's about 900 pages, and you can see it's small type. There's a huge amount of information here, far more than we need this weekend, just everything you could possibly imagine. For example, I was very amused. He talks in one place about some of the battles that the Muslims fought when they were attacked, and he lists the names of everybody who was involved in the battle. It says the Muslims who were present at the Battle of Badr, and he lists them all, every one of them. Yeah.
I've heard that book quoted.
It seems to be in the sense that many other books about Muhammad quote from Ibn Hisham. I've got some by Dermingham and Amir Ali and some of the other noted contemporary Muslim scholars all quote Ibn Hisham, so they all seem to regard it as being pretty good, and that's all I have to go on. Plus the fact that the things he says seem to fit in with the Baha'i concepts, and you'll see this as we go along. There's one thing here, I guess I can't find it now, about one of the battles. He listed all the Muslims who were involved in the battle, all the enemies of Islam who were involved in the battle, and then he lists the names of the horses of the Muslims. Why anybody would want to know that, I don't have any idea, but sure enough, I guess I could find it maybe at a coffee break or something, I can dig in and find it. But so there is very profound and also very inconsequential things there. Well, final comment before we really get started, and that is one of the difficulties that I think will occur this weekend is the difficulty of trying to separate one's thinking from several decades of prejudice in our culture. That our culture has prejudiced us in many ways against Muhammad and against Islam. Of course, when we become Baha'is, we start to roll back that tide, but there's still certain parts of it exist. We still have automatic feelings about Muhammad and about Islam and about the Muslims and what they did and stuff like that. And so we'll be continually sort of coming up against that during the weekend within our thinking, that try to overcome that. Yes? Yes.
In the Quran. And yes. I've read the chapter, but I haven't been able to find anything about Bob's commentary and how it was that, what he said that proved that he was Bob in this particular story.
Yeah, we can make a fairly introductory reference to it as well when we get to talk about the prophecies. I don't have a lot of light to cast on because I am like you. I haven't been able to talk to anyone who's read the commentary on the Surah of Joseph. I only have fairly superficial things to say, but I'll certainly say them and maybe they'll help, maybe they won't. But that's one of the things I've got down to talk about. But let me not promise you that it'll be a dazzling ray of light. It probably won't help at all, but at least we'll try. Fine. Well, let's get started and talk about the background. The first thing I want to do is to talk about the geography of the area. Let me draw up an awful map. This is the Mediterranean. This is the Red Sea. This is Arabia, around here. And then around where the rabbit is Mesopotamia. The Tigris-Euphrates area, Baghdad, be about where the rabbit's leg is, and Persia off in space there. Okay? The places we're concerned with are, of course, Mecca,
concerned with, this is out of scale, Medina, which is 270 miles north, roughly north. We're concerned with a couple of other places we go along, a place called Badr, which is about 20 miles out of Mecca, so this is 270 from Mecca to Medina. Badr is about 20 miles roughly out of Medina, so you can see the scale is not correct there. We'll also talk about this city called Khyber. And the reason we'll talk about it, of course, is the fact that Baha'u'llah refers to it in the Book of Certitude. The latest edition of the Book of Certitude has some notes, explanatory notes at the back. And they make a monumental lulu about Khyber. They say that Khyber is the Khyber Pass in the Himalayan mountains of India, which is dead wrong, because in the Book of Certitude, Baha'u'llah speaks about Muhammad going to Khyber and the things that happened to him there. Well, Muhammad went to this Khyber, not to the one over in the Himalayas. But that's good. I mean, by the way, it's not terribly important. Damascus, be up about here. Below Damascus is a city called Muta, called Muta for want of a better way of pronouncing it. But that also figures because a very important battle was fought there between the Byzantine Empire. It had a princedom centered in Damascus, and it was aggressive towards the Muslims. They fought a battle there, and some very outstanding Muslims died in that battle. So we'll talk about that at some time. Another place we'll talk about is the city of At-Taif, A-T-T-A-I-F, which is roughly 70 miles east of Mecca, and was distinguished by the fact that the city was dominated by a giant idol in the centre of the city, which I think was 70 feet high. Much the same as if you went to a European city, be dominated by the huge cathedral, or At-Taif was dominated by a huge one-eyed idol. I think it's the same Hobel. And we'll see how that was associated also with Muhammad went to At-Taif in the year 620, and we'll talk about that as the time goes on. So that's the main places that we'll be concerned with. That's roughly where all the places are. Across the Red Sea, of course, is Abyssinia or Ethiopia. And it figures a great deal in this, with a Christian kingdom. The king was called the Negus, N-E-G-U-S. And he, as we shall see, very interesting things happen. Mix the manifestation together, I'll call the Muslims Baha'is and the Baha'is Muslims. But Muhammad sent a proclamation to certain kings, including the king of Abyssinia, and the king of Abyssinia accepted the Muslim faith as a result of that proclamation. We'll read some of the things that happened at the time. Down the bottom of Arabia is the province of Hijaz, which is quite important to us because it was very fertile. It was an agricultural area. They grew vegetables. They had flocks. They grew cotton in certain parts of it. It was quite a rich area. Abyssinia was quite rich. The Mesopotamia area, what present-day Iraq, it was also very fertile land. And, of course, there was up here the Mediterranean with its somewhat developed civilization, and on further to the Byzantine Empire centered in Constantinople or Istanbul. So that's roughly the layout of it. There's a mountain range runs down the side here. It's not tremendously important to us. It's important to us in a couple of little bits and pieces. We'll find that Muhammad spent quite a bit of time in the mountains around Mecca. We'll find that one of the crucial battles in which Baha'u'llah discusses in some detail, the Battle of the Confederates, was fought in a mountainous area around Medina, but the mountains won't play a very major role in this. As you might expect, the climate is very, very hot in summer, extremely hot. We'll see as we go along that this provided a very easy way of torturing the early Muslims. They went and stuck them out on the desert and put a stone on their chest so they couldn't move, and let them die of thirst unless they were willing to recant their faith, which of course they weren't willing to do. So the heat of the desert figures in some of the events that occur. It gets very cold in winter. They occasionally have snow in the mountains around Mecca, not very often, but it gets occasionally down to that temperature. They don't get a lot of rain in this area. The countryside here, as I understand it, is largely very barren. It's not so much sandy desert, but barren land with stones and not much growing and fairly bare. There are, in addition to that barren land, there are two other things. One, there are areas of sandy desert, which would be kind of like the beach, you know, sand, shifting sands, things that you conventionally associate with Arabia. The other thing is that there are several oases where there is water and palm trees and things like that. And they're generally the areas where the cities were. Naturally, people settled near an oasis. Thirdly, there are areas of lava where there presumably were volcanoes many thousands of years ago, and there is lava rock, black lava rock, which is, you know, very porous and real bad on the shoes. That's not terribly important to us. It is important in the sense that in the Quran, Muhammad at times makes reference to the black rock and associates it with some of his prophecies. Now, let's focus in on the two major areas of interest to us, Mecca and Medina. They're quite different as cities, and the differences are important to us. These are some of the things that I'm dwelling on because they're important once we get the story going. Mecca is a city. I'm going to start rubbing some of this out. Mecca is a fairly desolate city. It's like a bowl in the sense it's flat in the middle and there are mountains all around it. So if we looked at it in cross-section, we've got mountains and then the flat thing in the middle and then mountains all around. I've got an old drawing of Mecca, which you can look at this in the break. It's this thing, Muhammad by Dermenheim. He's written many large books on Muhammad. This is a small pauperized one, but there's a little drawing of Mecca there and gives you some idea of what we're saying about the mountains. That's the geography of it. The rich people lived in the center of town, whereas nowadays, if you're rich, you'd get a house up on the heights. Well, it was different those days. The rich people lived in the centre of town. The closer to the centre, the wealthier you are. The people who were poorer lived up in the hills, and out in the desert were the Bedouins, the nomadic Arabs who were travellers who didn't have a settled house. Mecca was probably the major city of, well, certainly not probably, it was definitely the major city of Arabia, and it was the most important city for two reasons. One is associated with trade and the other is associated with religion. Mecca was the trading center for the entire region because it was the crossroads. Great trading caravans intersected in Mecca. The produce from Hijaz, the food, the spices, the cotton came up, was brought by camel train up to Mecca. The trade from Abyssinia and from East Africa came across the Red Sea up to Mecca. People from Damascus, from the Byzantine Empire, came down to Mecca to trade. A lot of the produce and goods from Mesopotamia and Persia were traded in Mecca. It was sort of the place where everybody met to trade. Be sort of like London in its great days, when London was, in a sense, the capital of the world as far as trading went, and the British Empire was centred on that. In addition, from India, the things from India, mainly jewels, some foods, some manufactured goods, things that have been carved and so on. They were brought to ports, it seems, as far as I can read, to ports around here and then brought to Mecca. My understanding is that there wasn't any very well-developed ports around here. There is now a port called Jeddah, but it wasn't developed at the time, and so they were brought there and then across land to Mecca. But the important thing is that Mecca was a big trading centre. What they did, every few months they held a trade fair, and literally many thousands of people would come. And it'd be sort of like our state fairs. They'd do business and they'd have all kinds of, a lot of horsing around as well. They would have poetry contests. This was their greatest recreation. Long poems would be composed and read to the people who'd come to trade. The best poems would be hung in a position of honour. There were also highly immoral occasions. There was a great deal of immoral going on, prostitution and things like that happening at the times of these trade fairs, so they weren't sort of all that refined in that sense. But they were very important because they brought people from a wide area together and ideas were interchanged, and it was there that the revelation came to Muhammad, and this of course fits in with the pattern of history that so often a religion has originated at a place which is a crossroads. And of course this then gives rise to the attack upon religion, that it's a product of the area rather than something initiated by God. But certainly the religion originated at a place which was a crossroads, and that's quite crucial to the story. We go along, we'll see the fact that this was a crossroads figures very importantly in some of the very, very crucial things which happened. Every year, the Meccans who lived on trade, you know, much the same as sort of the British people in the golden days of Britain, they themselves would finance two great caravans. One caravan would go down to the Yemen, to Hijaz, another caravan would go up to Syria. And the whole city was involved in those caravans, either with people going on the caravan or with people financing them. Typically, a caravan had 300 men and typically 2,500 to 3,000 camels. Let's see, when a caravan like that left with 300 men, it'd be roughly equivalent to a caravan of 3,000 trucks. You'd see, this would move a huge amount of goods. So you can imagine a city in the United States sending out 3,000 trucks to take produce across the country or to go and bring produce. It's a major event for the city. And we'll see that Muhammad was involved in these things, and again, that played a very crucial role. So that's the trading importance of Mecca. The other importance of it is it's religious. It was the religious centre for Arabia. And the religious centre that Mecca was associated with the Kaaba. This is a building in the centre of Mecca. You know, the flat bit in the middle, the mountains on each side. In the middle of the flat bit is a building called the Kaaba. It's 55 feet long. This is my engineering mind coming out, giving you the dimensions. 55 feet long, 55 feet high, 45 feet wide. You can see, for those days, that's a pretty large building. That's equivalent to a five-story building. Five. You imagine out in the desert, five-story building. Great big stone building of those dimensions. And it was a center of their worship. They covered it with cloth each year. They came to worship there. The reason they regarded it, yes.
What did they worship? I mean, like, was it just idols? Or?
Yeah, they had 360 idols. 360 idols in the sense that every tribe in Arabia had their own sort of domestic idols, and they also had an idol which they kept in the Kaaba. And so when they came for the trading, they would go and worship their idol in the Kaaba. So it was a big conglomeration of idols. From what I've read of descriptions of it, the idols weren't very highly sophisticated. Some of them were chunks of stone, a piece of stone out here, but they worshipped it. So
what was the origination of it?
That's the next point. Coming to there. Did you have a Anybody else have a question? Okay. The thing originated in this way. Traditionally, the Kaaba was regarded by the Arab people as being a center of worship that was built by Abraham. We know from history that Abraham, with Hagar, right? Is that how you pronounce it? Hagar was in this area, the wilderness of Paran, as it's called, and I'll refer to that again a little later, with Ishmael, the son of Hagar. And the tradition is, well, the story in Genesis confirms this, that Hagar was expelled from the family through the instigation of Sarah, and Hagar and Ishmael remained in this area, and Abraham was very saddened at this, and a revelation came from God and said, don't worry, they will be all right. I'm going to read the passages that relate to that a little later.
Ishmael was promised a lot of friends.
That's right. That's we'll get into some of that in a second. Tradition also, there is a well in Mecca called the Well of Zamzam. And the tradition says that when Hagar was expelled from the family with a little small son, Ishmael, she was nearly dying of thirst, but she prayed to God for some way of relieving her thirst, and the water came bubbling up out of the ground, and that water is the Well of Zamzam. It's in the precincts of the Kaaba in Mecca. During the golden days of Islam, when Muhammad made his declaration, when he was ultimately accepted by the people of Mecca, the Well of Zamzam became a very holy place. The feeling that it was associated with God's mercy to Ishmael was renewed. They would come to the Well of Zamzam and regard it as a very holy act to drink the water of that well. In the decline of Islam, one of the things that happened is that the Well of Zamzam became all blocked up. People, nobody looked after it. A lot of sort of junk and dirt and stuff and stones blocked it up. And I'm told, and this is simply a pilgrim note, but I'm told by Mr. Karim, if I heard him correctly, at a conference a year or two ago, that now we have a Baha'i community in Mecca. Well, of course, we know that. And one of the Baha'is of Mecca, who is quite financially well established, one of the things he did for the city, he cleaned up the Well of Zamzam, and it's now functioning and providing water for Mecca. And Mr. Kardem, and of course the rest of us, also felt it was very interesting that it should be a Baha'i who had the sense of devotion to the history of Islam. It should be a Baha'i who tidied up the Well of Zamzam. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Muslims are supposed to, Mecca.
Yeah.
Well, if you're in Mecca, which direction do you go?
To the Kaaba. And in fact, in the Kaaba, there is a black stone. The building is this big building, a five-story building in size, because it has about five levels, one level. And in it is a black stone, which is 6 inches high and 8 inches wide. And tradition regards it as the place, as the altar where Abraham worshipped. People, yes, I'm sorry. That's quite all right. Quite all right. I want people to break in any time. So.
Isn't this black stone perhaps the only or one of the only stone idols that Muhammad kept from the old days, so to speak?
In the sense that it was, the thing was, every tribe had their idol in the Kaaba, and then every tribe worshipped the god associated with the idol, and it also worshipped the supreme god associated with the black stone. And Muhammad came and he said, there is no god but Allah. Allah is the supreme god. So he used the black stone as a symbol of the supreme god, but it wasn't an idol in the sense that an idol is generally taken to be that stone thing, idol, is the God, is where the God is living or where the God is represented, whereas Muhammad took it as a symbol, just as we would take the nine-pointed star, or the Christian would take the cross as a symbol, but no Baha'i would say that the nine-pointed star is Baha'u'llah or whatever, or that the cross is Christ. So Muhammad took it as a symbol. In fact, what you've done is raise a very fundamental point, and it is this, that it seems that in every dispensation, the manifestation takes things which had been debased and sanctifies them. And this occurs in the Quran, one of the quotations I was reading, preparing this course, where Muhammad says this. He says that every manifestation sanctifies things that the people had debased. For example, we're getting into sort of minute detail, but in one of the rites of pilgrimage of the people in their pre-Muslim days, they would go to two certain mountains around Mecca, and they would throw stones or something to symbolize throwing stones at the devil. Well, Muhammad, in his pilgrimage that he gave to the Muslims, he had them go to those same two mountains, but go there and worship God rather than throw stones at the devil. So it was a sanctification of things that were debased. And I was thinking to myself when I read that, what is there in the Baha'i faith which has done that? And I really think there are many things. For example, voting and contribution of funds. To me, these are two things that are debased in our society. Voting is a joke. You know, you've got to have $1 million to run for Senate, let alone for president. And everybody buys votes and people vote for the same old person, this kind of stuff. Well, we Baha'is are doing better. We've still got a long way to go, but we're doing a whole lot better. So that it seems that Baha'u'llah has sanctified the process of voting. The process of contribution of funds, particularly to a religion, had become debased in our society, the way religions twist your arm and the corruption that goes on in the use of funds by religion. Again, Baha'u'llah has sanctified that. So I think you've raised a very fundamental point about things that had a debased or very corrupt meaning were sanctified by the manifestation. And of course, this thing is a source of attack. For that reason, they say, well, you know, all you've done is just compromise, whereas in fact it isn't compromise but rather sanctification. It's a subtle difference. Now, the black stone is apparently, from people who've looked at it as geologists, it seems to be a meteorite. They thought for a while maybe it was a piece of volcanic stone, but now the generally accepted view of geology is that it is a meteorite. It really doesn't matter what it is. It certainly is a stone that's there that was used as a centre of worship. And a person who's in Mecca, a Muslim who was facing towards the place in worship, would face towards the Kaaba. If he was in the Kaaba, he'd face toward the black stone. That was the centre of worship. Just as we as Baha'is face the world centre. If we're in the world centre, we face towards Akka. If we're in Akka, we face toward the shrine of Baha'u'llah. That's the centre of adoration for us. Now, that is tradition. What comes now is fact, because it's in the Quran. And the Guardian tells us that the Quran is an absolutely authenticated repository of the Word of God. And in the Quran it says this: the first house of worship appointed for men was that at Mecca. And this we can take as authentic because it's in the Quran. The first house of worship appointed for men was that of Mecca, full of blessing and of guidance for all kinds of beings. In it are signs manifest, for example, the station of Abraham. What the station of Abraham means is a matter of conjecture. My guess is it means the place where Abraham worshipped, but that's just my own guess. And around the Kaaba are certain other buildings, building reputed to be the spot where Abraham stood when he decided to build the Kaaba. That is venerated by Muslims, just as we as Baha'is regard as holy the place where Baha'u'llah stood when he commanded Abdu'l-Bahá to build the shrine of the Bab. Remember that clump of trees just up from the shrine of the Bab where Baha'u'llah stood when he told Abdu'l-Bahá that's where the shrine of the Bab is to be? We regard that as a holy spot. We have beautified it that way. Well, so Muslims beautified the spot where Abraham stood when he decided where the Kaaba was to be. Now, Okay, so that's why Mecca is the center of worship. Around Mecca, for several miles, the area surrounding Mecca was given a special name, Haran. Yes. It's all right, I don't mind it. Don't mind that.
Somewhere I heard that, like, the center for the Islamic faith was Medina and not Mecca. And the reason they picked Mecca was because they felt that way they could get in good with people that were Muslims. Is that true?
No, it isn't. What happened, it is described by Baha'u'llah in the Book of Certitude. And what happened was this, that originally, when Muhammad gave his revelation over a period of 22 years, and originally he commanded his followers to face toward Jerusalem when they pray. And as we'll develop as we go along, but in the year 622, Muhammad went from Mecca to Medina. And while he was in Medina, then he would lead the faithful in prayer and they would face towards Jerusalem. Well, one day, in the middle of the prayer, as we'll sort of jump ahead, but it doesn't really matter to me. The prayer has four parts to it. You go down on your knees and put your forehead on the ground and you start over and do it four times. Well, halfway through that, revelation came to Muhammad that he should change direction from Jerusalem to Mecca. And he did so in the middle of the prayer. And some followed and some didn't. Well, Baha'u'llah discusses this in about the first part of the Book of Certitude. The question Baha'u'llah says, how come? He knows the answer, just asking us. He says, how come did this happen? How come, for example, there was change from one place to another? Isn't one place as good as the other? And secondly, of course, Baha'u'llah doesn't use such colloquial language, but, you know. And secondly, why did revelation come to Muhammad in the middle of a prayer like that to change, switch now? And Baha'u'llah then goes on to answer those questions. He says, sure, one place is as good as another, but in every dispensation, the way of God has been to choose a certain place as the center of worship. And he goes on to develop this because it is a way of inducing unity, a sense of brotherhood, of facing towards the one place, symbol of the worship of God, etc. The second question Baha'u'llah takes up is why did it happen in the middle of a prayer? And Baha'u'llah says, and again, I'd probably be almost blasphemous in paraphrasing his words this way, he says that you better learn that every time a manifestation comes, he tests the believers. He says this was a test. That if Muhammad had received revelation, tomorrow we change direction. We gather the Muslims around and say, tomorrow we change direction. They'd all go back to their tents and think about, oh my gosh, you know, should I or shouldn't I? Well, I guess he's a manifestation. Okay, I will. But you couldn't do it. You had to decide in a split second. You didn't have 10 seconds to think about. You had to decide now whether you were going to switch. And the thing was, it was a difficult test because most of the early Muslims were from a Jewish background in Medina, where they were used to looking to Jerusalem. If they were, you know, pagan Arabs, and what the heck, you know, they don't know where Jerusalem is. But these were the Jews who regarded Jerusalem as sacred, they accepted Muhammad and become Muslims, and now in the middle of a prayer, bang, they've got to decide to change and look at Mecca. And that's a test. And he says, of course, that this is the purpose of God, that he'll test you whenever you think you may be tested some more. You know? And that happened, of course, the same thing happened in the dispensation of the Bab with the Conference of Badasht in 1848, when the followers of the Bab, some of them hadn't completely understood the fact that the Bab was an independent manifestation. And then the Bab abrogated the laws of the Quran. Well, that was as big a test as anything. It happened suddenly when Tahira came with her face unveiled, although abrogated the traditions of the Quran. So, and that was a test. You know, were they going to sit there with Tahira among them without the veil, or were they going to run away or pick up a knife or whatever the person did? They had to decide there and then. They couldn't think about it for 24 hours. It's the same sort of thing. And of course, we have the same in the Baha'i faith and the various things that have happened in the history of Baha'u'llah's relationship. So this is basically the way it happened. Well, the religion at the time There were the people of Arabia, the Arab people, are descendants of Ishmael. And the religion that most of them had was this pagan worship, idol worship, rather. So they would be regarded as pagans in that sense. They worshipped stone idols. There were Christians and Jews. The Jewish people were concentrated, for the purpose of the story, in two places. There was a Jewish state in the Yemen, down the bottom of Arabia, and there was also a pretty strong Jewish colony in Medina. Medina was quite different from Mecca. Mecca was rough and stony, a trading centre, a religious centre. Medina is fertile. It's quite good land. There's agriculture goes on around Medina. It's a different kind of a city. There were a number of, just quite a strong Jewish colony in Medina. Christians were somewhat few and far between. Christians were in the Yemen. They were generally being persecuted by the Jews. It was sort of the other way around. The Jewish people held the material power, and the Christians were the struggling religion trying to get itself going, and they're persecuted. As I mentioned, Abyssinia was a Christian state, and there were some Abyssinian Christians who'd settled in Mecca. Some of these were associated with trade, and others were slaves. But there was a small Christian colony in Mecca, and there were Christian traders who travelled through Arabia. In Persia, there were a number of Jewish people, and there were some Christians, yes.
Were there also Christian clergy and churches?
I'm not sure about Mecca. There certainly were in Syria and Damascus.
What about Christian property?
Christian property. I'm not certain. I don't know. If I was to guess, I'd say no. But that's only a guess. Because the base of my reading, that Christianity doesn't seem to be in any way established in Arabia in the sense of having churches or property or even any system of organization. It was in Syria and thereabouts and in Egypt, but not in Arabia. It seemed that pagan, that the idol worship had pretty well resisted Christianity. If the word was very, very slight, I think I could say that with some confidence. Christianity was a missionary religion in Persia. There were churches in Persia, there were Christian communities, although there were quite a lot of Jewish people there. And that'll be quite significant because as we go along, we'll come across an interesting person called Salman the Persian, who Baha'u'llah praises. And his story is a very fascinating and in some ways mysterious one. And he will see that he started off in Isfahan, and his story begins with his hearing of Christian missionaries in Isfahan, but that's kind of jumping ahead. So that was basically the Christian and Jewish situation. Well, do you want to go on for another 15, 20 minutes, or do you want to stop? Go on. Okay, 15, 20 minutes more, and then we'll take a break. So much for the geography of the place, now the history. The history of the place is really very simple. Two big empires bashing each other to pieces. Simple as that. One was the Byzantine Empire, and the other was the Persian Empire. The Byzantine Empire was centered in Constantinople. It had reached its peak, let's say, with Constantine. Remember, he accepted Christianity in 310, 312 AD, and he reigned, I think, till 337 AD. The Christian dominion centered all around the East and North Africa, centered it at Constantinople. After Constantine died, he was succeeded by his descendants. Eventually, there was dissension between them, and the Byzantine Empire split up into two bits, the East and the West, divided among two sons, as I remember. I'm kind of hazy on the details, but I remember that much. There were two sons who were both eligible to be king, and the best way was to give them half each. And so the empire was divided in the year, I think, 395. And that had quite a major role because these two parts, the east and the western part of the Byzantine Empire, then started to drift aside. In the west part, they were having all kinds of troubles with the barbarians who were turning up, the Goths and the Huns and so on. Rome fell ultimately to the barbarians in the year 410 AD, and then, of course, the whole character of the western part of the Byzantine Empire changed. Eventually, in the 500s, the 6th century, the 500s, yeah.
Now, when you say east and west, are you talking about, you know, the European section and...
Yes.
Oh, right. We're not talking about like...
No, perhaps. I'm talking about the European section and the Middle East section.
Oh.
The Middle East section be the east and the European section be the west. So the west part, after it split into two, and the west part sort of went off on its own, it was more vulnerable to the barbarians, and Rome fell a few years later in 410 AD. Then after that, they struggled to maintain some semblance of civilization. A century later, in the 500s, the Pope in Rome started to gain power. When it seems to me from my reading of the historians of the time that although the papacy is traced back by Roman Catholic to St. Peter, the power of the Pope to determine, to have authority over other bishops, only started to emerge in the 500s, the 6th century.